Okay, good morning, everyone. Welcome to our Lam Rim Chen Mo class. We're studying the perfections. To do so, we will begin by setting our motivation in front of the merit field. So make yourselves comfortable in your chair, which means, you know, adjusting in whatever way you want to, so that your back is straight, your shoulders relaxed, and you feel at ease. And when your body feels at ease, while you keep breathing normally and naturally, become aware of the movements that take place in the body each time you inhale or exhale. And while you continue to breathe normally and naturally, imagine that the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas from the 10 directions appear in the space in front and above you. And that every other unenlightened being, every sentient being, appears sitting on the ground and surrounding you. And every one of these sentient creatures, every one of these beings with mind, with consciousness, is related to you in some way. They've been mothers and fathers to us, uncles and aunts, brothers and sisters, children. And while we've been in relationship, our happiness has always depended upon their kindness. Yet while they too wished to be happy and avoid suffering, every one of them equally was never genuinely happy. Things have changed, and the causes and conditions to awaken are present. So resolve to quickly attain for them the state of enlightenment. And by doing so, help them to turn their mind to the truth. To practice that truth as a path, to help them remove obstacles from their path, and to purify their confusion into wisdom, thereby revealing their natural birthright, a state of unchanging goodness. Now, to help us do that, and like I said, because the causes and conditions are present for us to do so, we're going to take refuge now in the lineages, the families of the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas that are in front of us, slightly above. So we take refuge and generate the mind of enlightenment. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By my practice of giving and other perfections, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By my practice of giving and other perfections, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By my practice of giving and other perfections, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. So, stabilizing this wish and then enhancing it, we recite the prayer of the Four Immeasurables together. May all sentient beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. May all sentient beings be free from suffering and the causes of suffering. May all sentient beings be inseparable from the happiness that is free from suffering. And may all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free from attachment for friends and hatred for enemies. So to accomplish enlightenment for the benefit of others, we need to abandon the forms of speech and thought and activity that prevent our enlightenment. And we need to accumulate all the causes and conditions that bring enlightenment about. These are all to be summed up together in the seven limb prayer. So we'll recite that now to inspire us. Reverently, I prostrate with my body, speech, and mind. I present clouds of every type of offering, actual and imagined. I declare all my negative actions accumulated since beginning this time and rejoice in the meritable whole and ordinary beings. Please remain until the end of psychic existence and turn the wheel of Dharma for living beings. I dedicate my own merits and those of all others to the great enlightenment. Now, one of the major obstacles to enlightenment is the clinging that we have to ourselves, the world around us, and our actions, and particularly meritorious actions. So here we're going to imagine vividly the absence of clinging towards these objects, and in their absence, have your own body transform into a wonderful pure land that we offer to the Buddhas in front of us, where all beings can take teachings. So the short mandala, this ground, anointed with perfume, strewn with flowers, adorned with Mount Meru, four continents, the sun and the moon. I imagine this as a Buddha field and offer it. May all living beings enjoy this pure land. Yida mandala kanyatayami. So the mandala is accepted by the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas in front of us. They smile at us in delight. And then this refuge field begins to dissolve into light, melting into the central figure of Shakyamuni Buddha. He begins to decrease in size, then moves through space and abides above the crown of our head. Facing the same way we are, he starts to descend through space, entering the crown of our head, coming down to rest at the level of the heart. Now light begins to radiate, expanding, filling our chest, all the limbs of our body, the head and the mind. Light moves out through the pores of our skin into the 10 directions of space, completely filling it. And wherever there are beings within that space, they're touched by that light and transformed into fully awakened beings. And from the heart center of each of these awakened beings, rays of light go out into the 10 directions of space. Now the light begins to withdraw, once again entering your body at the level of the heart. And you find yourself breathing normally and naturally, feeling embodied in your seat. There's an awareness that very deepest nature of your psyche has this potential to be fully awakened. And when it is, it brings about your welfare and the welfare of every other living being. And it's through engaging in these studies of the Lamrim Chenma, it's by trying to put the practices into effect that we can bring about that full awakening for the benefit of ourselves and others. So this is what we're trying to do. This is our goal. So just affirm that, then breathe in deeply, and then exhale through the mouth. And bring your awareness back to the screen, and then we'll have a look at what we'll be doing today. So of course we're up to class 8 this year, and we've been focused around these 6 perfections, but particularly the focus has been on the first perfection, the perfection of generosity. So what we've covered first of all is to look at some of the different obstacles to the perfections and the antidotes to them, how to begin development, and we've looked at some of the divisions of generosity. We've also looked at some of the motivations to be adopted and others that have to be abandoned. And we're presently engaged in a section about how to give and how not to give. And last week we looked at the offering of the inner, meaning the offerings of the body itself, how to give it and how not to give it. And I've relied upon these particular texts, mostly upon this bottom one here called Lamrim Chenmo, the one straight above it, Steps on the Path to Enlightenment by Geshe Sopa, and also on Khyentse Rinpoche's commentary. And in relation to Khyentse Rinpoche's commentary, I've gone across and looked at the different questions that have been put up there for the examinations, and then made sure that they've been answered here in each presentation. So, you know, if it ever comes to some stage where you wish to do those exams at all, you'll know the material has been covered. Now, today we're going to look at the outer things. And first we'll look at how not to give these outer things, then how to give them, and finally we're going to look at what we can do if we find ourselves unable to give these outer things. And like I said, in brief, we'll be answering these 6 questions today. So the first question is, what circumstances make it inappropriate or wrong to give away a text you find yourself working on? Second question, what skillful means can you employ to not offend a person who's asking for that text? And in general, how and when should we give? And how do we begin to reflect in order to overcome the natural sort of stinginess that we have? If we can't make ourselves give generously, then what should we do? And will that solve the problem? So these will all be answered, and basically nearly all of this material, these questions are answered, come in the last few slides. Until we get there, we'll just go through as we can. Now, if you remember last week, we began with like a brief presentation, and then there was quite an extensive presentation. So this section here works quite similarly. Mm-hmm. So when we come to the brief presentation, we're looking at, like we say, the outer things. So outer things means impermanent phenomena that are not our body. So that could be food, it could be books, it could be money, it could be houses, clothing, all these sort of things. So when we look at those objects, the objects that, these outer objects, we don't want to be given things that are harmful at present and will harm others in the future, because it'll harm us and the other. And we also don't want to do things that are pleasant in the present but have long-term harm. What we'd rather do is to try to give something. If it has to be, then it has to be. It might hurt a little bit at present, but it won't in the future. It brings about long-term help and gain and health and so forth. Or even, even best of all, something that is pleasant in the future, present, pleasant in the present, and in the future also. So like we, we saw last week, this was sort of related to the inner things, meaning the body. This time it's related to the outer things, meaning things that are not the body and are impermanent. So how not to give outer things. So here we have five headings. So how things can be inappropriate from the viewpoint of time, from the viewpoint of the gift, the person, the material things themselves, and finally from the purpose. So there are some things that are proper to give and others that are not. And similarly, there are good times and bad times for giving. There can be positive reasons for doing something and negative reasons for avoiding doing that same thing. So a positive reason is the purpose or goal of the action, and a negative reason details the danger or negative repercussions of performing that action. So we have to examine which is greater. So if the negative outweighs the positive, then we shouldn't do it. If there is a small negative reason, but the positive benefit is greater, then we should do it. So here, Geshe Sopa sort of saying, we have to be like a really intelligent parent. So it's a bit dangerous and even stupid to allow children to do everything they want to do, simply because we love them. So this is why actually it's quite a bit of detail related to these five headings there. So, Lama Tsongkhapa explains in detail about when to give, what to give, to whom to give, the types of material things you can give and the purpose behind it. And so what we're going to do first is look, is take each of these headings here and go into each one of them with a little bit of detail. So let's begin by looking at the time, first of all. So here we're looking at how not to give outer things from the perspective or the viewpoint of the time. Now, in the Lam Rim Chenmo and in the commentaries by Geshe and Geshe Sopa, they really just focus here on the example of using food. So food, as you know, is something that we all need. But there are wrong times to give food, to offer food. So, for instance, as you all know, the vast majority of the ordained do not eat after lunchtime, after noon. And so they try to start eating before noon, and as soon as they stop eating for a period of time, that's the end of their meal. So it would be inappropriate for us to making an offering of food after noon. And it'd be inappropriate for them to accept the food after that time. So not only that, but you also know, you know, so when people are fasting, it would also be inappropriate for us to offer food, wouldn't it? Now, so some of you guys know about, you know, the Mahayana precepts. When you do, you have one of the days is like a complete fasting of food. So that would not.
It might also be, you know, like people have to fast before they go have a test at hospital. That's like a more mundane example, but can be a bit fraught.
Yeah, so you don't want to do, in terms of the Mahayana precepts, on that day that the you abstain from food altogether. You don't want to be offering food after lunchtime the previous day. And in terms of, you know, sometimes, like you say, the doctors will say, don't eat anything the next day. So if you knew that somebody had been given that instruction and then you offered them food, that would be inappropriate too. So this is sort of getting around just inappropriate time to make offerings. So then we can sort of extrapolate from that. But like in the text, it's really sort of focusing around the perspective of time in relationship to meals. So inappropriate time from the viewpoint of time. Now we come to quite an interesting section on the gift itself. And here I've put up a picture of a text or a book as the gift. But when we look at the material that's covered, there's much more than that. And what the other thing is I really put up once again is food. So you've got food and drink, Dharma books and paper. So a gift might be inappropriate when we consider the recipient. So you should not give religious practitioners leftovers or waste scraps of food. Also, do not give food contaminated with urine, snot, vomit, blood, spit, and so on. Now, you might think to yourselves, oh, you'd never do that. But I've been with people who did exactly that to others. Not to monks and nuns, of course, you're ordained, but to other people. So I know people do things like this.
But even, Eddie, like contaminated with spit is not necessarily spitting in the food, but just taste testing it. So, you know, there's many, many people, many chefs included, just taste test dipping the spoon in again, double dipping. So, you know, that might work for a bit, but, you know, in times of COVID, that certainly wouldn't work.
Yeah.
The other thing is that leftovers, now that's a bit of a worry. I didn't know about that.
Okay. Yeah, well, I guess that's why we're sort of studying Lamrim, isn't it? Because that's what we find a lot. We find a lot of things we just didn't know before. So this is, you know, further, some people do not consume certain things like meat or alcohol, onions or garlic. So then it's not suitable to give those people those things. So if someone is not permitted to eat a specific kind of food because of certain vows or because of health reasons, then we should not give that person anything made with that ingredient. Now, next comes up four other types of objects, four other types of gifts that we could make, which could be inappropriate to do so. So I'll just mention these, and then perhaps I'll open up Geshe Sopa's book, and we could have a little talk about it, because it sort of expands on them. So first of all, here are some other gifts that we should not give away. So giving away a child, a servant, or and the like, which means basically a family. So even if you clearly convey the significance of the giving and they are pleased with it, but when it's been requested by someone you delight, you dislike, or someone overcome by belligerence who is ungrateful, or someone forgetful. So I know it seems really weird to us now, you know, we're living in Australia and so forth, but you know, it's still going on nowadays, isn't it, where people give their families over in servitude to others. They become the servants of others. Actually, just saying that, I think, wow, that's what happened in our family. When my mum died, my father gave away our youngest daughter, our youngest sister, to another family, to our relatives. And she lived there for like the rest of her life. We didn't see her for years and years. And when I did see her, you know, one of the things she said, oh, you guys were so lucky that you lived together. At least you had one another. And then it transpires like she was like an indentured slave to them. She was just like a servant. So even in, like, in my lifetime, I said, well, okay, so my dad gave away one of our family members to another part of the family. We didn't see her again. So even in in many of the third world countries, this sort of thing is going on. When people are given into the hands of others. The next thing comes down to, it says, giving scriptures to non-Buddhist philosophers who have commercial interests or are seeking points of criticism or do not want to learn the meaning of the scripture.
Eddie, just before you go on, Bruce has got a question wondering about some of the food that we offer to food charities. Yeah. Is that called like giving leftovers? Or like is the giving leftovers specifically not to give to the Sangha, but, yeah, you know, we can give leftovers to our friends?
It's specifically to the Sangha, Bruce, in terms of the leftovers. Yeah. So I've mentioned here giving the scriptures to non-Buddhist philosophers who have commercial interests. So, you know, like you can go into bookshops and you'll see a lot of Buddhist books on the shelves. And even second-hand bookshops, you could go there and you'll find, you know, quite a few Buddhist books on the bookshelves. So I remember, I think it was even in the Lam of Chenmo, or maybe Geshe said it one day, was don't sell your Dharma books. Don't sell them for the money.
And Eddie, I remember, every now and again, when somebody dies or when somebody loses their faith, then we, you know, we get a donation of Dharma books.
Yeah.
But there has been a couple of times where people have lost their confidence in Buddhism and then just stuck on Facebook, oh, I'm selling all of my Dharma books now. Yeah, right. At least I want to get some money back for them. And that just makes me really sad.
Yeah. So he's saying, the advice is don't do that. The other one is to, like, give your Dharma materials away to others who are just looking through the material to find points that they can criticize and debate with you and point out where you're mistaken. Now, I should say right now, so in many ways, like, this is the beginning of something, because suppose we came into contact with a person that, you know, we understand this person's a bodhisattva. And then we find that they actually give away one of their texts to a person who is, you know, yourself is quite adverse to Buddhism. So then we've got to ask ourselves, like, you know, why is this being done? So it could quite easily be that from the point of view of the bodhisattva, they know in the long term, yes, it'll disturb them and so forth, but in the long term, it brings great benefit. So I remember a story very similar to this about a great bodhisattva who lived in this valley giving teachings, but the royal, one of the princesses in the royal family was really spiteful towards him and didn't like him. And once a year, this bodhisattva used to come down to the village and give like a big, you know, they have a big puja and he'd give a big teaching. But each time he came down, he'd come down on his white horse and he'd take the horse through her vegetable patch so that it would destroy it. Right? He'd give the teachings. Well, she got really, really cranky about this and decided one day that she was going to have no more of it. So she dug a huge pit in there and put stakes in it and everything and then covered it up and said, next time you come through the garden, you're a goner. So this bodhisattva was warned by the villagers that the princess had done it. Nevertheless, he still went out, rode that horse through till it fell into the pit and the stakes pierced him and killed him. What the princess didn't know and what the other people didn't know was what the bodhisattva knew. So he knew that he had a karmic debt to her, and that actually if he sacrificed his life in this way, the debt would be repaid and she would go through so much remorse that she'd actually become ordained, take up the Buddhist path and become a great practitioner. So he went off and did it. And that's exactly what happened. So, you know, like for all of us, you know, none of us can read each other's minds. So we don't know many reasons, you know, why people are doing the things that they do. But like here, we can just see, like it's like I said, it's the beginning of the sort of thing. It says in the beginning, these things are prohibited. But you always got to put like a caveat there, like a however. Because bodhicitta is mental, isn't it? You know, it really depends upon the motivation of the person's doing it. So he says, don't give scriptures to those who are seeking points of criticism, and don't give them to those who do not want to learn the meaning of scripture. So actually at the end of Geshe Tashi Tsering's commentary on the stuff, he said, so don't you give away your Lam Rim Chimo. Now, another thing about the gifts, he says, if you give a fully written Buddhist text to persons of childish intelligence who ask for it, you incur a misdeed. If you ask others for it to give to them, you also incur a misdeed. Then finally, there's this, which maybe I should now have a look and get the book out a bit. So this is from Geshe Sopa's book, page 299 to 301. I won't read you two pages.
And Eddie, while you're finding that, can you also just clarify, so when it says don't give it to people of childish intelligence, then we need to know exactly what that means.
Well, what do you think a person of childish intelligence is?
Well, I'm assuming someone who's just interested in it for their own gratification or for their own sake, not necessarily for helping others.
Yeah, that'll do. That'd be one of them. Yeah, you can get other people who like books just for the sake of the book or to have them or for their covers. But they never, or like they just read it as a book.
So like just to put in their own Zoom background to look like that they're smart.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
So they'd be the people that sort their books out on the shelf by colour coding them, colour all the same coloured books together?
Not necessarily. They could do that and read those books and study them. But if they just put them up just to, for the colour code, yes. So in terms of the books here, Gesi Sopa says, we should be careful about distributing some books, even to people with good attitudes. So in relation to this, so, you know, I have a number of different books by Geshe Kalsang Gatsai, and I've read nearly all of them. And for me, I find them really, they're terrific. But Kensa Rinpoche said to me, don't lend these out to other people. Like, you've read them and they're yours, and you know, you've got them. Don't put them in prominent places in your bookshelves if you have other people, other Buddhists come over to your house, and don't share them with others. So, yeah, there was a book by him that had never been covered by anybody else. It was the only book that was out for years. A book on a commentary on Chandrakirti's Entry to the Middle Way. It was fantastic. And so others wanted to know of this, you know, what's about this text. So I had it. So my thing was always to preface it by, this is what Kensa Rinpoche told me, and you know this is by Geshe Kalsang Gatsai. And if it's going to disturb your mind, if you're going to think negative stuff about him or anything, you can't leave the book alone. You know, so I try and make it's quite obvious about what I'm doing, and try and live by the advice of my teacher.
Eddie, so there's a couple of questions coming up here. So Ian kind of made a quip of, say, perhaps not giving people a book just because they want to look at the pictures but don't want to read it. Though I would say giving someone a book just to look at the pictures, that'd be me. And then I'd just like glance on the other side and read a few of the words too. So that could actually be skillful means.
Yes, this is right. So this is why I said before, it's quite dependent. It's, you know, if you think of your mum, how she got into Buddhism.
Well, that's right. That's how Inta got into Buddhism right at the beginning, was by buying a book with the picture of Tara on the front. And why she bought it was because she just loved the jewellery, the earrings and the necklace. She bought the book and started making jewellery and earrings just like Tara. Didn't even see Tara. And then, you know, several years later, then actually read the book. But first off, bought it just for the jewellery. So Ian, there's quite a lot that can be skillfully done like that. But Jeanette says, you know, then aren't we actually judging people then before we give our books away?
Yeah, and we need to. And there's nothing in Buddhism that says don't judge people. It really depends upon how and why you're making these judgment calls. This is called your discriminative wisdom, discriminative intelligence. We need to use our ability to discriminate. Mm. And there's also, so Geshe Sopa also says, reading particular books may be too difficult or even dangerous for those who are unprepared for the teachings and practices contained in them. So, yeah, often there's quite a prohibition, isn't there, about sharing many of the books on Highest Yoga Tantra to those, as you go, where's this person's mind at? We have to make, you know, we might ask them a little bit.
And also sharing books on emptiness, so that, you know, when you're very young, you don't just go straight over into nihilism.
Yeah.
But then also Kate said, so she has a grandson who likes to debate with her. He's 17. He's clever. He's looking around to understand the world. So is that okay that he picks up my Dharma books?
Well, you know, from your, so I was saying before, like Kate, you know, so here it's sort of making a gift. Right, so if he picks the book up, you haven't made a gift of it to him. He's just picked it up and having a look at it, and then wants to debate and so forth. But if you like think, actually, this is good, that he's asking these questions and so forth. And I have a lot of confidence in the Dharma. I know it's not hurtful and it's very, very good. So actually, you can make him this gift of it, right? With the intention to, like, yeah, I'll debate you. You know, you have this good intention behind it. So it's not just to give it to him so he can argue with you. Yeah, even though, and like I said before, even though, you know, we have taken the bodhisattva vow and so forth and are called bodhisattvas, but, you know, just a little bit of reflection upon that, well, actually, perhaps I actually don't have the mind of enlightenment, so really I'm not an actual bodhisattva. Nevertheless, I would like to become enlightened and I would like him to be also. And so I'm going to offer this book that's at a level where he can actually understand it and then engage in debate with you. You know, because you actually, you know, wish, his thing might be, I just like to argue. But like I was saying before, if it was to argue out of malice or to poo-poo you and so forth, and that was just it. You know, but nevertheless, you can still see a higher purpose here. You know, but you've got to be careful here about the type of literature and the level.
Eddie, then also Rosemary's brought up a point about, you know, the complete barbarians in our culture that we are, that if we know, say, that the people will read the book and learn from it and enjoy it, but we're also worried that they don't treat it respectfully as Dharma. For instance, they might just keep it on the toilet floor, you know, have it in the toilet.
Yeah.
So because I also remember a similar thing like this living in a share house years ago where we had a picture of the Dalai Lama on the back of the toilet door.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's this thing of like how if you're a Dharma practitioner, that's incredibly disrespectful. But if you're a barbarian, actually it meant that there was harmony in the household. So what do we do when we're worried about people won't treat the Dharma books respectfully?
Well, we can talk to them about that, and then after that it's up to them. So here it says we must determine what the people want, why they want it, what we should do, and how to do it.
So Jeanette's also asked about this. So that does that mean that we have to look at the other person's motivation for wanting the book?
Well, we need to ask them not why would they want to wish to for us to give them this book? Because remember, there's a gift going on here. We are going to give a person this book. So we've got to be quite sure in our mind why we're giving that person the book. And then you could ask them some, you know, if you say, I'd like to give you this book, but I'll also ask you, like, you know, sometimes people read in toilets. If you're going to read it in the toilet, you can say, please don't. But if you do, don't put it on the floor. You know, and you explain why you would like them to be respectful to this reading material. You have to explain in a way, this is not just a book. This is not a, you know, this is not like the books you just normally read, the non-fiction books you read and so forth.
Yeah, and actually spelling it out's probably good, because I think back to my time in those share houses and things weren't spelt out and people were just, you know, trying to find their way and break all the rules and things. So if you...
So I've got a thing here with you about, you know, this childish intent. Yeah. So here he says, a childish person has no noble intent. He or she merely wants to play with or sell the text. So bodhisattvas would also incur a downfall if they request others to give religious texts to such people. However, there is no downfall if a bodhisattva thinks, even though this person has a poor attitude, I will give him this text. I will give this text to him or her because in this way I will be able to lead him or her to have faith in the Dharma.
Right, so In a way, then childish intent can also be what often happens in our culture about being kind of academically proud. So you give a gift to show off rather than it be, you know, something beneficial for them.
Yeah, that's right. So you know, you're looking at your own intention when you make you give them the offering. So, yeah. So, like I said here, in relationship to your question, Kate, you know, he said, "So I'll give the text to him because in this way I'll be able to lead him to have faith in the Dharma." Now, whether the Bodhisattva is actually able to inspire the person to have faith in the Dharma is not the deciding factor. If he or she thinks that he or she can do it, then it's appropriate to give it.
So that's really nice to not be focused or attached on the outcome, whether it's possible or not, but the intention.
Yeah. So here we come to this last one. We talked about the paper. So here's the fourth one. If someone asks you for a stack of paper, which is being prepared for a text, you have to inquire, what are you going to do with it? If the reply is, I'm going to use it for commercial purposes, and the stack of blank paper is one that you are preparing for religious purposes, do not give it. So here, in relation to this, Geshe Sopa says, there are also special considerations concerning the giving of paper. In the past, paper was a rare and valuable commodity, so bodhisattvas had to be careful about giving someone stacks of blank paper. If someone requests a supply of paper, a bodhisattva should ask in return, what do you want to do with it? If the person answers, I need money, so I want to sell it, the bodhisattva should give the person some money instead, particularly if that paper was originally intended for the printing of Dharma texts. If the bodhisattva does not have any money, he or she should still not give the paper. The publication of Dharma books will benefit many people. Selling the paper will be helping only one person. Once again, we must compare the benefit of helping one person, if we were to give the paper, with the broader benefit the greater public will receive if we withhold it. Now, if the paper was not intended for the printing of religious texts, then we can give it away, because satisfying someone is an appropriate use of a material possession. We should similarly evaluate giving paper to those who request it in order to publish something they have written. If their work is extremely negative and they want to print it just to make money, there is no fault at all in refusing to give it. A bodhisattva should not give paper, even if the person's composition is only slightly bad or simply not so good. In contrast, if some people want to print a sutra or another spiritual text that would be beneficial to other sentient beings, bodhisattvas should assist them by giving whatever they can. In that case, not giving the paper would be a downfall. So when I read this, the first thing that flashed to my mind was when Lama Zopa and Lama Yeshe first came to Australia to give teachings at Happy Valley, and it was all muddy and all the students put the newspapers on the ground so that they would walk on it, and they wouldn't walk on it. They were quite upset that the paper and the writing would be put in the mud. That's what came to my mind. This is probably about this, you know.
Eddie, so Jeanette has a question about what would happen if, say, for instance, a Shugden practitioner asked you for a Dharma book written by His Holiness.
Yeah.
How would you handle that? So I wrote back about, you know, you'd joyfully give it to them, of course, especially if they asked you. But Jeanette's asking, wouldn't you have to question their motivation?
I would think so. I would think I'd ask the first, why do you want this book when you have so many books written by your own guru, Geshe Kelsang Getso? I would ask. If I knew that they were a Shugden practitioner, I would ask. Because it might be the case that they wanted to burn it or destroy it or do something destructive to it. And if that were the case, that would be very harmful for that person. So you don't want to do that.
But if they just want to read it, you know, then that can only be good.
Of course, if they want to read it, but like I said, you don't know that. That's why I would suggest the first is to ask, why do you want this book? Now, if they're saying, I would like to read it, I'd like to see what His Holiness says that are so different than my own guru. You go, yeah, sure.
So we would, Jeanette's asking, would we have to go deeper and question their motivation for it? So do you want to read it?
Yeah. Why do you want this book? For sure.
Well, why do you want the book is different from why do you want to read the book?
Well, are they asking for the book or are they asking that they want to read the book? If they're saying, yeah, I really like to read that book, you could ask them still, why would you like to read the book? When you have so many books by your own teacher who covers so many of these topics. There's no, I think that'd be a skillful means. Because once again, you know, you read the books by His Holiness and you read the books by Geshe Kelsang Getsa, there's no thing that you can go, that's not right. There's nothing like that. The only difference is, like, you know, there's only one book I don't have of his, and that when it talks about the actual Shugden practice, there's a book that actually has that practice in it. I'm not having that in my bookshelf.
So I'm a bit concerned about this because we've kind of forgotten that all of this questioning someone's motivation for reading a Dharma book.
Yeah.
I mean, really, we've got to make sure that we do it with an open heart and utmost friendliness.
Of course.
Because especially if someone from, a different so-called tradition or a different mindset, you know, or say a Christian or a Muslim asked you, can I have a book by the Dalai Lama?
Mm-hmm.
Wouldn't your first response be, yes, of course, rather than, well, what's your motivation for reading
it? Is the first response the right response? Is it the most skillful, correct response here? There's no harm in asking with respect, like saying, Professor, wow, that's really unusual. Why do you want to read a book by His Holiness?
Yeah, so that's quite different from, say Christian asked you, can I read a book by His Holiness? You wouldn't just say, well, what's your motivation? You'd say it like, you're really friendly and kindly.
Well,
wow, how amazing.
We talk about that coming up. We come to, so hold on a bit, right? This talk's all about how to give, what to give, the time to give, all these things. It's all covered. Anyway, it's just about 11, so maybe we should stop here.
Eddie, before you do stop, if you just stop the screen share and everyone put their camera on, and if there's any lingering questions about this, please, you know, wave at the camera, and then you can unmute.
Yeah.
So where's Jeanette? Jeanette, did you have any lingering... who else? Rosemary, did you wave? No, Delma waved.
I just wanted to ask, Eddie, you said that there were four categories there, a child servant and family, the scriptures to non-Buddhist people, yep, and paper. I think I missed the fourth.
It's the third one. For those with sort of childish intelligence, Delma.
Yep, thank you.
So when we, if you go through the, if you look at the Lam of Chenmo or even Geshe Sabo's commentary on it, that's how it's sort of broken off. So I've looked through it and gone, okay, there's these four types of, if you break this down, it's all covered by under these four headings.
Mm-hmm.
Head on. And that'll cover all the stuff. So here, of course, we're just looking at the the gift itself, what has been given, but then, you know, like Miffy's pointed out, there's a lot more to it. And that's why they go into such depth. And so one of those things is, like, well, when you give something, like, how do you give it? It's one of those things that says, you know, like, with a smile, you know, with respect, there's a lot you have to do to give as a bodhisattva does. If you have this attitude of bodhicitta, there's quite a lot involved in it, in just a simple thing called giving.
Eddie, so Jeanette, I'm not sure if you know that you're just writing to me privately.
Sorry.
Yeah, so Jeanette, just go for it, ask your question.
Oh, it's just the question of, you know, giving Dharma books to people. Like, I've got a friend who's not a Buddhist, but she asked me for a lot of advice.
Yeah.
She never criticizes, but it doesn't make any difference in her life. She still carries on. And I was just thinking, if I was giving a Dharma book to someone that I knew was a Buddhist practitioner, I'd give it joyfully without asking any questions. But if I knew somebody had an inkling towards Shugden, you couldn't just hand it over, could you? You couldn't just hand it over without question.
But why not? Because Jeanette, if someone has an inkling towards Shugden, then it's like we need to care for them and save them from that very sticky situation.
Yeah, but starting to doubt the teachings that they're receiving and need somewhere else to go. Like we have visitors to LTC that have been to Shugden teachings that doesn't feel right. They go looking for something else. So a book, giving a book might be just what they need. Mm.
The thing is, they're so openly against His Holiness, aren't they?
Well, not all of them.
The ones that I've heard are very vocally criticized.
Yeah, the activists are, but there are many people that just walk along and see a Buddhist center and go, great, and they don't even know that they're doing Shugden. They have no idea that they're doing a practice that is not a Buddhist practice in a Buddhist center. And that's the problem. Not that Shugden is a problem. It's just a practice. The problem is that it's presented as a Buddhist practice when it's not. So there are many people that just do that practice and they don't even know that it's different.
Yeah, I don't understand why they don't know it's different, Miffy, because His Holiness the Dalai Lama is a well-known figure throughout the world. And the main thing about the Shugden, I don't know a lot about it, but the main thing is if you go into you go anywhere, you won't see any pictures of His Holiness the Dalai Lama.
But that's right. And if you're an Aussie, bogan, and you go into a Dharma centre and you just see pictures of Tibetan men in robes, all Asians look the same. So how are you going to even know? It might be years before you know.
Oh.
Also, if you come from China where you've had no exposure to the Dalai Lama except to be demonized, then how are you going to be educated by another way? I mean, I'm asking this because I've often got Chinese students walk in and denigrate the Dalai Lama because they haven't heard any different.
Yeah, well, you'd have more experience than me, yeah. I suppose. I'm just going from the point of view of meeting some of these Shugden supporters, and they're so loud and aggressive.
You've got to remember, Jeanette, they're Shugden activists, which is quite all different right. from all the people just walking along in Spring Hill and going, wow, there's a great big Buddha statue in the window. I'm going in. So they're the people that end up coming to Lungri Tumpa Centre after a little while, some of them going, something not right, and now I'm really disturbed. how can there be politics happening in Buddhism? Mm.
All right. Okay.
Yeah. So also remember, Jeanette, so these people have actually taken refuge in the Three Jewels. They are Buddhist people. They're Buddhist practitioners. They've just got this added thing called the Shugden practice. And, you know, it's like all people, people can change their mind.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
If we can encourage them to do so and help them to do so, then I figure we should. But like I said, I also think, you know, like if you thought, you know, the Shugden person wants to read it, you go like, why would that be? Because they've actually been instructed by, you know, their teachers and so forth. You know, nothing to do with the Dalai Lama. Dalai Lama's against us. Why would you want to read this particular book? So I don't see any fault in asking that.
Mm. Well, neither do I.
Well, I want to burn it, or it's rubbish or something. We say, oh, I can't give it to you.
Mm. Yeah.
Somewhere else. But I can't give you this book. I'm sorry. You say that. If they say, my teachers have said all this, but somehow or other, I don't know why. What's different? You know, here you go.
Can I ask if we look at it after the break? It was just coming back to that thing, that third point about don't giving it to people of childish apprehension or behaviour. And I'd just like to get a bit, dig down into that a bit more as to why or what we're looking at, because just saying on the surface that just looks a bit judgmental and assuming things about people. And I'd just like to be able to investigate that a little bit further. Happy to do it after the break.
Yeah, okay. So here, just once again, I'm saying, some of you might think that, you know, you hear the word judgment, then I would ask you, like, what do you mean by that? Are you coming at it from the Christian perspective? Or coming at it from the perspective of...
Making judgment about somebody's mental capacity or childish attitude. And what exactly do they mean by does the wording mean by childish?
Okay, so once again, I'll describe... from the text, what they mean by a person who has described as a childish person, or someone who has childish intelligence. So it says, he or she merely wants to play with or sell the text. Then later it says, you know, even though this person has a poor attitude, I will give this text to them because you have faith that you can actually lead them to the path to enlightenment. So the person wishes to either play with or sell the text. These are examples they're giving of somebody of childish intelligence. Okay. Is that okay, Rosemary? Do you need more stuff on it?
Yep, that's cool. Thanks.
Okay, let's have a look. Is there anything else? What we've covered so far. So we've gone up to the gift. So now we're going to have a look from the viewpoint of the person. So I'll just go back to our screen share. So Khyentse Rinpoche started off his commentary by saying, the person here refers to you, the one who is giving. So we're going to look now at what not to give from the viewpoint of the person who is giving rather than from the viewpoint of the recipient or the object. Again, we take the example of religious books and unprinted reams of paper to learn who should and who should not engage in the practice of generosity. So having taken this bodhisattva vow and trying to act as bodhisattvas, we need to consider our purpose in keeping or giving away a spiritual text. So it says there are three purposes to giving religious volumes. One, to fight your own attachment. Two, to produce wisdom. And third, to benefit other sentient beings. Since the primary purpose of giving is to eliminate attachment, If bodhisattvas have a strong desire to keep a particular book, then they should give it away. If you check within and find that you have no attachment, you have to determine whether giving away the text would impede your ability to complete your intent for possessing the book in the first place. So in other words, if you have a book and you wanted to read it and study it and don't know what it's talking about, and you haven't done that yet, and you give away that book, you will impede your ability to have read it to know what they're talking about. If you could produce wisdom and benefit other sentient beings without the volume, then it would be right to give it away. However, if you could freely give it away, but without the text could not complete the other two purposes of generosity, then there's no fault in keeping it. So in order to attain Buddhahood quickly for the benefit of other sentient beings, the bodhisattva must accumulate merit and wisdom. The value of a scripture is the information within it. And we study books in order to gain knowledge. If a book will serve to edify oneself and increase one's wisdom, then giving it away would diminish one's opportunity to accomplish the accumulation of wisdom. And in that case, you should not give it away. Further on, Geshe Sopa says, the Lamrim does not provide additional details about evaluating the purpose of giving in specific situations, but Tsongkhapa does discuss how to act when we determine that it would be inappropriate to give a religious text to someone. We should not say anything harsh or hurtful like, I would never give this to you. We should say whatever is necessary so the person does not get angry and lose faith. He goes on to say, so what would be a skillful thing to say? So then he goes on, in answer, let us consider for a moment that portion of the Buddhist ordination ritual that requires monks and nuns to keep certain objects with them. In general, monks and nuns should live very simply, renouncing many things. However, in order to live in samsara, to study and to practice for the benefit of others, there are a few things that they should not readily give away. And these are the three garments that make up their robes, a begging bowl, and so forth. The ordination ritual instructs Sangha members to keep these items with the attitude that they are utilizing these things temporarily, but they really belong to others. At some point, it may be beneficial to give them away, but for the present time, the monk or nun should use them in order to be able to benefit others. So this point has come up quite often, hasn't it? In relationship to ourselves, you know, we say like, this body is my body, but it's on loan to me. It actually belongs to others. I'm just holding on to it, you know, and using it, but really it belongs to others. And the same thing with our possessions. We call them mine, but we remind ourselves that they're just on hold for others. They're temporarily mine, I'm looking after them, but really they belong to others. Yet when others ask for them back, we have to be quite skillful in whether we should return them right now or not. And then Geshe Sopa goes on to say, he says, this way of thinking is analogous to the bodhisattva's dedication of their possessions, but then keeping them for use. From the beginning of the bodhisattva path, practitioners dedicate their possessions, body and life, to all other sentient beings and to the Buddhas of the 10 directions. These things then belong to others. Bodhisattvas have them only on loan. Dedicating to the Buddhas or to sentient beings actually comes to the same thing. Essentially, they are saying, from now on, I'll only do what the Buddhas want, help other sentient beings. So when bodhisattvas judge it better not give, they must explain it in a nice way. They may say, these things are not actually mine. They belong to others. I'm sorry, but I cannot give them to you. Returning to the example of someone requesting a volume of scripture for inappropriate reasons, we can say, I'm sorry that I cannot give you this book, but please take more money than it's worth. By acting like this, the other person will think, it's not because this bodhisattva is stingy or mean or negative in any way. They simply do not have the authority to give me this book. So if one thinks and acts this way, even while accumulating great wealth, one will still create great merit. He goes on to say, there is nothing that the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas would not give to help sentient beings. When faced with an opportunity to practice generosity, we should give if the item is suitable as a gift. This is what the Buddhas want. However, if the item is unsuitable, or the time is not right, or the purpose is wrong, or there is some other valid reason, then even if someone asks us sweetly, we should not fulfill their request. Generosity with wisdom is the skillful bodhisattva practice. Even not giving requires skill and a lot of wisdom. You should know the purpose of generosity, how not to harm others, how to act for a greater purpose, and be able to evaluate various situations. Then your generosity will come out of great wisdom. So I would suggest we need to actually sort of slow down a little. I know my mind is very fast, yours might be too. And you can see here, even in this practice of generosity, you know, the simplest of all the perfections, there's a lot going on, there's a lot to remember. And that won't happen if we rush some of these things. Now, like I said, we do, I think, many of us have a natural inclination to give to others what they ask for us. And we think, oh, of course I can, this will be good for you. And so we just sort of hurriedly give. So here we could probably slow that process down just a little and remind ourselves of why we're giving the article. And especially when it comes to things like Dharma material, that might be the time where we actually really slow down a lot. Because I'm sure most of us would have no problems with the giving of food and so forth. But here they're just sort of saying, well, Dharma is of supreme importance. Give carefully and considerably. So, which leaves us this, being skillful with refusal. So you see most of these pictures have got books in it and so forth and food and later on robes. But it's like this, if you don't want to give this book, it's better for you to hold on to it. But still, you'd like them to have the book. Then you can offer them the money to buy it. If this is what you choose to do, you think, yes, this book would be very beneficial for them, but I can't give it to them right now, not this one. I think this might have been the one where Kensa Rinpoche said down the bottom, don't give away your Lam Rim Chenmo book. So, yeah, the skillful ways, these things don't actually belong to me, because they don't, do they? You're holding them in trust for everyone, for others. So if one single person comes up and they're asking, is it appropriate in some way? Their gift is inappropriate in some way. You go, I can't give you something that doesn't belong to me. But as you want it, perhaps, you know, here's the money. Buy it yourself. So now we come to this thing about the material things. And basically here in the text, they really talk a lot about the robes that the Sangha wear. So I should tell you a little bit about the robes and what they're called. So Geshe Tashi Sering actually says, so for those of you who don't know, the Chogu is the yellow robe that you will see everyone wearing on pujas and so forth. The Namja is a slightly more elaborate one for the ordained monks, and the Shamtab is the lower skirt. So when you often see, especially the monks, when you're first putting it on, they have quite a bit of difficulty putting that Shamtab on because they're not used to sort of wearing dresses. So there are different rules and prescriptions that the Buddha set down in the Vinaya, the texts on discipline. So as a monk or a nun, you definitely need two sets. One that you're wearing, and so when you come to wash that, you have another one to put on. So even though you have these extra robes, extra shamtab and so forth, you're not allowed to think of these as belonging to you. You don't think, oh, this is my robe. But rather you have to sort of, guess the calls it, mentally earmark it, thinking, this is, actually belongs to my abbot or master. There's a whole ritual that goes along with that. And then he gets to say, look, if you don't know the ritual, the most important thing is to think that actually these robes and so forth belong to my master or my preceptor or anyone else like that. And he says, you know, in fact, there's even a wider application as well. You can keep an extra robe thinking, oh, if I encounter someone who doesn't have a robe, then I can give this one to them. So it could be the abbot, it could be the master, or it could be someone else who doesn't have them. Because there is a ritual where you earmark your robes for that purpose, but if you're not able to do the ritual, you mentally must have this idea in mind. So I'm not sure if some of you remember some years ago, I think it was in, it must have been overseas. So Lama Zopa Rinpoche saw a beggar with no clothes and he started taking off his robes to give to the beggar. And the Sangha around him leapt up and went, no.
Eddie, don't forget to look at us.
Yeah, at
the camera. No, you're not.
Oh, look I'm looking at the camera. Oh, okay. Yeah, that's right. Oh, yeah, so thank you. So they all tried to stop Lama, and of course they did, but he was always taking it off, and they really made a effort to stop him doing it. So then Geshe said, this is really only taught for the Gelongs, meaning the fully ordained monks. It's not explicitly taught to the Getsels or the novices. Nevertheless, Geshe thinks it would be good for novices to develop this idea, to have this idea in mind. So as I had said a few times before, you know, I think the thing to take away from, one of the things we've sort of got to hold on to is that the life we're leading now belongs to the Triple Gem and all sentient beings. You know, that's what we're doing. I know, I just looked at you going.
Look at the camera.
Okay, so now we're going to come to look at the purpose for giving. So it says, you know, we should not fulfill the request of someone who asks for poison, weapons, fire or intoxicants for the purpose of harming others. In addition, it's not right to give something to others if their reason for wanting it is to amuse themselves in a way that will create a cause for them to be born in the lower realms. For For example, there are places where people kill animals for sport and entertainment. And here in Wisconsin, many people enjoy going hunting. In the latter case, if we grant another's request for a gun, we may give them a little temporary pleasure, but because they will use it to harm other beings, it will bring them a great negative result. We have to examine the purpose to which the gift will be put. Giving to someone so he or she can harm animals by archery, trapping, fishing, or any other means is not right. We should not instruct people in methods that could harm others' bodies or their lives. Then he goes on to say, sometimes countries cede areas along with the people living in them to the winner of a battle or war. But a country's ruler should not give territory to someone whose intent is to harm the residents. So this is an example on a very large scale. But it is a model for how we should behave, even regarding small pieces of property.
And also, it just makes me think about in Australia with Indigenous land rights as well, giving the land away for mining.
So here, Gitsy Sapra says, we should not give or sell real estate if the other party's intent is to destroy the creatures living there. So that would sort of talk about what you're talking about, Miffy. Well, if you destroy the habitat of the beings living there. When practicing generosity, we are fighting against selfishness and trying to increase our desire to help others as much as possible. We are certainly trying not to harm other sentient beings. So Gensa Rinpoche says there are instances in which it is inappropriate to give due to some temporary circumstances, because there's something you like want to avoid in not giving right now. There is a prohibition, because if you were to give, there would be some negative outcome. And hence, for the time being, it's not appropriate to give. So what he's sort of saying here is that right now, like we looked at before about time, it's not the right time to give this. But a little bit later, it may be the right time, so then you give it then. So once again, like I'm looking at this material and reading it, and hearing it as I speak it, you can really see how the role of dependent arising plays in everything. Now, everything is dependent upon other factors. Now, and some of the factors here, as you can see, is purpose, the thing itself, the gift, and the time to give. So let's look now at how to give external things. So how should we give? According to the Vinaya, it's proper to give if it is not an inappropriate time nor an unsuitable object for that particular person. So the time is right, the object's right, the person's right. So that's a good time to give.
So, Eddie, this seems like a mental checklist that we have. So we want to practice generosity and we've got this checklist. Is it going to have any of these negative things happen? So how not to give? Tick, tick, tick. All bases covered. Okay, then I can give.
Yeah. So remember years ago, if you asked me about that little orange Buddhist book I had, and it had the section on how to give? Now, so these are some of the things, and this was really shocking for me to read that. You go, wow, there's so much in the simple act of making a gift that you have to consider.
Yes, well, that's the one that I use in the How to Give Gifts at Christmas, because it really covers everything of how to actually make a good gift.
Yeah. So here we've got to remember, is the time right? Is the object right? Is the person right? So that's, sort of three things to hang on to. However, from the point of view of us, the person, the practitioner, the purpose of generosity is to reduce stinginess and attachment. So then there's this lovely line that says, a bodhisattva should think, I'm going to give this text away to reduce my attachment. Even if I remain stupid my entire life, it's better than remaining so stingy.
So, Eddie, I've been trying to do this with the clothes that I make. So, whenever there's a special event, I make something in particular and decorate it and whatever. And so now I've got quite a few things. And then, I heard that saying about better to give things away now while you're alive than wait till you die. And so I've been trying to give one away every now and again, and it's so hard.
We found it difficult. We have to consider the person. Miffy and I sit there, who would this suit? We start running through different names. Then we work out what time is the best time to give it. And then what do you say when you give it? How do you give it?
And so then all of that can happen, but then the person actually may be so overwhelmed that they'll never wear it anyway. And so then I'm still going, oh, but I haven't quite given it away in my mind yet.
So, from the point of view of the object, we should give it so long as it's not harmful or dangerous. We can give people things for play and enjoyment if they will not use them to create negative karma, leading to rebirth in the lower realms. Those things themselves are not absolutely harmful. It depends on how they're used. So if we're asked to provide them for a positive purpose, it's right to give them. In the proper situation, even weapons and poisons are not problematic gifts. In this context, weapons can refer to the special knives used by surgeons, and poisons can be compounded into powerful medicines that cure disease. In summary, if it's not a harmful situation and the things will not be detrimental, it's right to engage in the practice of generosity.
Eddie, that makes that distinction then between being superstitious about it, like don't give knives, to actually being smart about it, of is it going to create harm or not?
Yep, we've always got to consider that. So then this question's asked, what should we do if two people, one rich and one poor, come to us and ask for the same thing? So Geshe Sopa says, sometimes there will be a conflict about what to do. But in general, one should decide how to proceed beforehand, thinking, if I can, I will fulfill both their wishes. If I cannot do that, I will help the poor person. And then you have to say in a nice way to the wealthier person, I'm so sorry, I've already dedicated this thing to the other one, to someone else, so I can't give it to you now. So this explanation is not a lie. We're just trying to help the other person understand. So there we have this thing called, what happens if you're unable to give? What should we do? It's me when I'm older. So here, he says, if we are so overpowered by stinginess that we cannot part with an object, we should ask ourselves, why do I feel this? Why do I feel this stinginess, this miserliness? this thing and I are separate. There is no way we can stay together. Sooner or later, I'll have to leave it, or it will leave me. This is the nature of things. So that's where we talk about impermanence here. Secondly, this object has no real essence. It cannot produce everlasting happiness, and it may cause me some problems. However, if I give this thing away, it might give someone else some temporary pleasure and free that person from some passing suffering. In addition, this act of generosity will become the cause of my future wealth. So generosity has a real positive essence. Even if I were to die because of giving this thing away, it would not really matter. Sooner or later, I have to die anyway. If I am tight-fisted and hold on to my possessions all my life, I will still have to leave them at death. Then I will experience misery and regret my parsimonious actions. But if I practice generosity, I will create merit that will comfort me at the time of death. Wherever I go in my next life, I will bring karmic seeds with me, just as a shadow follows a form. Whether my karma is good or bad, it will eventually ripen. So if I give everything away now, when I am dying, I will know that I've used everything in a positive way. This will give me great joy. So there's a lot going on here, isn't it? A lot to recollect. Impermanence, emptiness, karmic cause and effect, death itself. So we try and call on the practice of what we understand from the lower scope and the medium scope of how things actually are. Then he goes on to say, well, let's say you've thought this through and you still find yourself unable to give. In that case, when others seriously ask you to give them something, you have to be able to give them some excuse. The words you use will depend upon the situation, but the meaning you should convey is this: I am just a beginner in the practice of generosity and helping others. I can't do this because I'm still under the sway of attachment. He says, the bodhisattvas who realize emptiness can practice generosity, but I'm not like them. I'm still under the control of my selfish, egotistic view. I still grasp at I and mine. So please excuse me. Have patience. And please do not be unhappy because I'm not able to give this to you right now. Later, I hope you ought to do something that will satisfy you and all other sentient beings. So even though you do not give them the material thing that they requested, your nice way of excusing yourself can please them. And it said, yeah, this idea comes from the questions of the householder, Ugra Sutra. And in relation to that, there's this quote here. It says, if a beggar comes in front of you, but you are weak and unable to give, without disparaging the beggar, you should please him with kind words. In the future, when someone asks for things, do not be discouraged and depressed. Clear away the fault of stinginess. Make an effort to eliminate grasping. So this has come from Arya Shantideva from a text called the Compendium of trainings. So I think there are only two texts that Shantideva wrote. There's the Bodhisattva's Way of Life and the Compendium of Trainings. And this quote comes from that. And the idea behind it is to prevent people from losing faith in beginner bodhisattvas. So, you know, for most of us, other people will know that we are Buddhists. They might not know anything about the bodhisattva vehicle and so forth, or what we're doing as Buddhists, what we do. Yeah, and sometimes people say to us, don't they, but aren't you a Buddhist? Especially if they see us eating meat, they go, but you're a Buddhist, aren't you? So there are these assumptions about us, aren't there, if they know that we are Buddhist. So one of the assumptions might be, you know, they, when they're asked for things, they should like give them.
Look up at the camera, Eddie.
I have to read now. And, you know, so what to do if we find ourselves unable to give? So the suggestion of, you know, using kind words, explain to them, look, you know, I know you know I'm a Buddhist. I'm not a very good one. I've just started. I'm just on the path. I'm not even on a path, actually. I've just started. They said, well, you've been going for 10 years. Yeah, and there's so much to learn and know and then to do it. I'm not really good at it. So I'm sorry. You know? So you say these gentle, truthful words that excuse you from being able to do this thing right now. He says, this mode of action will prevent people from losing faith in the beginner bodhisattvas who are not able to practice generosity even though they've taken the vows. So although it prevents distrust between people and does not reduce stinginess and doesn't avert breaking the bodhisattva vows. So it does prevent the distrust, but at the same time for us it doesn't decrease our stinginess, it doesn't stop us breaking the bodhisattva vow and so forth. Lama Tsongkhapa says that if we do not give material things or do not teach the Dharma because of tight-fistedness, we create the heaviest kind of downfall. Stingy selfishness is so egregious because bodhisattvas are motivated by a wish to benefit others all the time. So once again, you know, we need to check our own mental continuum to see, do we have that type of attitude? Of course, if we don't, we have to acknowledge to ourselves that we are definitely beginner bodhisattvas. So if bodhisattvas do not give, it should be because they're trying to accomplish something else virtuous out of compassion and love. Then Geshe Sopa says, when ordinary people have a lot of stinginess, it is shameful. It is far more despicable for bodhisattvas to be miserly. If we do not give, but excuse ourselves properly, we lessen the weight of the downfall. We will still be breaking the rules, but because we do it with a regretful, heartfelt apology, it is nowhere near as severe. And so this quote is sort of trying to get at that.
Eddie, so my ears are pricked up here because mentioned in that giving is also the thing of giving a Dharma teaching. So I'm thinking, say, if you're asked to lead meditation or give a talk at a school or something like that, that would be included in there.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, so it's quite, it's like you said before, many of us don't know how to engage in these activities. We just don't know. And because we're new, we're really new at this. So we are studying this text. And the text, you know, shows us this knowledge of now we know. So, like, if you know and then go against what you know, and that would show this idea of what he's saying about, you know, the stinginess. But yeah, for some people are asked to give lead meditation classes and so forth. Now, or give a teaching somewhere. Now, whether they're lay people or ordained, often there's a moment of freak out panic straight away. So as Buddhist practitioners, we need to investigate that. We need to accept that this took place then. And what's happening from that? Are we getting, you know, becoming tight and scared? It's like, I can't do this and I can't do that. But what's going on then? You know, we need to be sort of reasonable, honest, and sort of make a kind inquiry and ask ourselves, why are we not doing this thing when we have made this promise to help others? You know, that our body and our speech and all of our attitudes belong to others and the three jewels. Why are they going, no? And then, you know, as we said before, then we can challenge it. Because the whole thing is, from our side as the practitioner, is to challenge that type of stinginess. And then you might find yourself, you know, volunteering at the center. We'll try to help someone.
So then we have to be really honest whether we say, you know, I can't do that because actually I am a really terrible cook, or I, you know, no good on a computer or something, or I can't do that just because we're terrified and we're panicked and we don't want to.
Yeah, like that, whenever you say, like, you know, I'm a beginner. It's true that I've entered, you know, I am a Buddhist. I take reference to the three jewels, and it's true that I've also taken the bodhisattva vow. But at present, I'm unable to do this, whatever it is. And you have to explain yourself, honestly.
So Eddie, you know, way back in the day when Inta was still alive and she asked you to lead classes.
Yeah.
So when you were first asked, you said, oh, well, I can just sit there and play the tape.
Yeah.
So how did you get through to actually going, well, okay, then I'll lead a class?
Well, because that was what I did. So I, you know, like when Miffy's mum, Inta, asked me, so I thought, well, yeah, I can talk. I can talk about truth or suffering for sure. I can talk about that, and I can speak from my experience, and the text is fine with me. But when it came that you said, "Yeah, I'd like you to lead the class in meditation," I went, "Oh no, I can't do that." But I know how to do it, but I'm not going to do it. Or I am going to do it, but I'm going to do it like this, you know. So I had a what do you call those little things? A little sort of
a tape deck.
A tape deck. Thank you. I had a tape deck with Penday Horta's meditations on, you know. So I go, okay, I'll talk. Now the meditation, hit, and then Penday would lead them through the meditation. I go, hit, and now back to the class. So the first time I did it, I was going through it, and Inta walks out and goes, stop, take it away. It was like this thing, and she said, you meditate, don't you? And I went, yeah. She says, just tell them what you do. Oh, well, that's easy. So in my own mind, I thought meditation was something other than what I was doing. You know, and besides, I thought, I'm not very good at this. You know, like, even though it was working enough for me, at the same time, I thought, well, it won't work for others. And Penday is a monk, and he's been doing this for years. You know, I'll just play the tape. It'll work. Apparently, Inta had a bit more in mind for me.
And luckily so.
Okay, bye-bye, Rosemary. Thank you. So, look, we've come to the end now of our class. Is there anything else anybody would like to add to it? Or if you have a particular question for me? Delma? Yep.
Sorry, I'm just saying goodbye. I've
got to
go.
Okay, mate. Bye-bye, sweetie. I'm going to dedicate. I'll just put these last two slides up, eh? And then let's get it over with.
Yeah, so I'll just butt in here that Delma and Rosemary are having to go because they're helping lead a volunteer's lunch. And so there's your ultimate generosity, I reckon, of actually giving up your own enjoyment of class to nurture our volunteers that mean that we have a centre that runs that mean that we have classes.
Right, this is the material for next week. It's all there. We just continue. I just dedicate it all to your enlightenment and to the enlightenment of every other sentient being also. May we quickly develop a mind of bodhicitta, enter the Mahayana path, enhance bodhicitta with the wisdom realizing emptiness, and become fully enlightened for the sake of others, meaning we'll bring them to enlightenment too. So let's aim our lives at that goal. Thank you very much, everybody. And enjoy the rest of the weekend. And see you, Bruce. See you, Linda.
Meta. Wave at the camera. Woo-hoo. If you stop the screen share, you can see everybody.
Okay, folks. Thank you very much for being here. And see you next week. Bye-bye, Meta. Mm-hmm.